You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where it's like Westeros, except with less incest, patricide, zombies, and dragons. Okay, so it's nothing like Westeros. Couldn't you just let us have this one? Another season of Game of Thrones is in the book, and while I'm thankful they didn't kill Tyrion, I'm not nearly as excited as everyone else. I'll keep watching the show, I'm just not eagerly anticipating its return the way I am a show like The Walking Dead. Joining me this week, via Skype from Austin, Texas, Daniel T. Richards.
Hi.
That's it? That's all you got to say this morning?
Well, usually you say, like, how are you, Daniel, or what's going on, or what's the news in Austin, Daniel? Today you're just silence.
I thought I would give you more leeway this morning.
No, the thing, it is earlier than usual when we record this podcast, dear audience. So the last thing Justin needs to give me is more leeway because I will either go to the angry end of the spectrum or the lethargic end of the spectrum.
Okay, so do you have anything you want to say about Game of Thrones then? Or maybe how I mispronounced Westeros the second time I said it in the opening?
No, I just think you need to change your name to J.M.M. Lesneski and write some absurd political theater set in some bizarre time and or land and get rich so that we can all take a vacation to the Bahamas.
Well, I'm sort of doing that with my novel Timeless. It's a bizarre political theater set in a world outside of the timeline. So I won't be changing my name, but I'm sort of doing that.
But people with more middle initials are smarter. Don't you remember we did that story?
Yes, I remember that from last week.
Okay.
I don't hold to that. Also joining me this week via Skype from Orlando, Florida, Elliot Rivera. And Elliot, I'm going to ask you how you are.
I'm doing very well, thank you. Then again, it's 12 noon here in Orlando, so I've been up for a little while already.
Everyone doesn't just always sleep in on Saturday? I thought Sunday was the Lord's Day of Rest. What's going on?
The who?
The what?
Oh,
when are we?
Lord's Day of Rest, you mean? We'll never be royals, that Lord?
We also do not have God in our version of Westeros. I don't know if they have God in Game of Thrones. No, the crazy lady with the red hair worships the fire god or whatever, right? I don't even know. I don't even understand what's going on in that show half the time.
Isn't it just about boobs and dragons?
Pretty much, but you know what Game of Thrones doesn't have and needs more of?
What?
Racism.
Oh.
So let's get right into it with the news with Daniel T. Richards.
The Redskins trademark is no more. The Federal Patent and Trademark Office of the United States of America has decided that the Washington Redskins football team trademark is disparaging. And so it has decided to cancel that trademark, which basically amounts to the legal equivalent of a slap in the face. Because basically it will continue to be a trademark through the appeals process and it won't actually force the Redskins to change their name. But what it will do is allow really sneaky people to sell clothing, hats, tomahawks, or other offensive apparel with the Redskins logo on it.
You mean what probably happens outside the stadium anyway?
Right. Exactly.
And I would love it if the government, just when they were trying to socially pressure people, would just run up to them and slap them in the face and run away. Like if Nancy Pelosi or Harry Reid started doing that, I think that'd be hilarious. Can we make a YouTube video series of that? Somebody dressed like them doing that?
Slightly less harmful than what they're doing now, I suppose. So probably an upgrade.
By the way, other team names I find disparaging. The Oakland Raiders and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, why are we continuing to oppress pirates?
And they're like the last group that we're allowed to sincerely make fun of.
The Houston Texans, why are we trivializing everyone who lives in Texas as just the Texans as a mascot? What's up with that?
The Miami Dolphins, not all dolphins look like that.
Yeah, but they're not people, I mean, so it's okay. You can make animals mascots.
But they're almost people. They're like the next smartest or whatever.
Well, they do rape people as much as Game of Thrones, so.
It's true.
And finally, yeah. the final team name I find offensive,
mm-hmm.
the New York Jets, but that's just because they're the New York Jets.
Right, has New York in the name.
Yeah, I remember down here in Florida, the Seminoles, there was a little uproar about that, but then the Seminole Nation actually said, no, we like the team having our name, so leave them alone. So they haven't been bothered since then.
So to give them the, quote, benefit of the doubt here, the thing, if it was like the Washington Seminoles, for instance.
Or the Cleveland Indians.
Right. I don't think it would be as much of an issue, but the issue is with Redskins being offensive, even though multiple Indian nations go to the games all the time with Redskin pride jackets on. But forget that. White people are offended, so we have to do something. So to me, this is a really bad precedent mm-hmm. for the patent office. If we start declaring patents invalid because they're disparaging or offensive, then there's no end to what a politically motivated patent office could do.
Mm-hmm.
So to turn this around on leftists, I've been asking them all week on the Facebook if it would be okay if a conservative influenced patent office decided to cancel patents related to pro-choice or atheist groups because they found them disparaging to religious groups, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there's no answer to that. The answer is, oh, well, that wouldn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, so, is what would Jesus do patented?
Trademarked?
Yeah, trademark, patented, whatever probably. The legal jargon is. Because technically that's against the Bible. That's a, you know, creating all these idol stuff you're not supposed to create. And in that sense, isn't American Idol offensive? Isn't that a false idol?
In so many ways, Justin. In so many ways it's offensive. But I think it plays into a bigger issue, which is a misunderstanding of the ideas of things like intellectual property. I think that's one of the few points of contention, I think, between a lot of libertarians and other liberty-minded groups. Like Objectivists, for example, I take intellectual property seriously. I think a lot of us do, but there are those that kind of don't. And I think that this kind of conflict arises when society really doesn't have a clear idea of what we mean by that.
It's true. So there's also an hypocritical element of all of this, which is that there are trademarks that are much more offensive than
like
the
New York
Redskins.
Jets.
So the Daily Caller put together a list of some of the more offensive ones that they could find.
Was Tucker Carlson's bow tie at the top of it?
You know, he doesn't wear that anymore.
I know, I miss
people
it.
Like me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you kept making fun of him, you best.
Then the doctor started wearing it, and it became cool again, and Tucker Carlson was just behind the times. What are you going to do?
Oh. Maybe he'll pick it up. That'd be cool. So, for instance, let's see. Cracker as niggers skateboards.
I don't know as a white person if I'm offended by that. I just kind of find it funny.
Figures over niggers. Is a clothing apparel line. I don't even know what that means.
Wait, what was it again? One more time.
Figures over niggas.
So, like, action figures are more important than black people?
I don't know. I don't know what figures means. I don't speak that. Blanco basura, which seems like an innocuous phrase, but translated is
white trash.
Basically white trash. Yeah, well done. Teensdoporn.com. I don't know why that's offensive, but it's on the list. uppity Negro.
What? that brand?
It is intended to be imprinted on mugs and apparel, references the frequently used adjective in the Jim Crow South era. I'm not even sure.
Do all of these just have to do with rap?
I don't think so, because this last one, which is my particular favorite, all natural, my dad's nuts, caramelized jumbo Redskins, which is a line of savory peanuts.
They had to have made that name to be satirical.
Well, part of this article points out that there are like seven other trademarks that use the term Redskins, and those aren't being canceled.
Right, but are they all referring to Indians? Because the nuts isn't referring to Indians.
Well, how do you know? And does it matter?
Mm-hmm. That's the word. Once you establish a legal precedent, I mean, you open doors that you would never think of opening. You know, especially when they're politically motivated like this. When you're talking about political.
So basically, this process is like killer clowns from outer space. Another door.
Yeah. I'm gonna watch that.
We need that drop for the podcast, by the way. So yeah, this is a terrible precedent in my opinion, and I can't wait to see how conservatives use it so that the left can be pissed off but not remember that this thing happened, so that we can have this discussion 10 years from now and be like, do you remember when you did that? And they're like, no, F you. So all of this is too dumb for my little brain to comprehend, which means I can probably be a cop. Mint Press News is asking the question, can someone be too smart to be a cop? To which we laugh and laugh, but the answer is actually yes, quite. Although it's not widely known, federal courts have ruled since 2000 that police departments can legally opt to not hire someone simply because he or she scores too high on an intelligence test. The Millennium ruling followed a lawsuit in 1999 by resident Robert Jordan, who was told by the New London Police Department that he could only interview candidates who scored 20 to 27 points on an intelligence test. Jordan, a 48-year-old college graduate, scored a 33, which made him above average intelligence and therefore ineligible to give out chicken shit parking tickets.
I love how the police use the same exact IQ test as the NFL, the Wonderlic test.
It's a pretty standard, isn't it?
I've never seen it. The only time I've ever heard of it is the NFL. Have you guys ever taken it or seen the test before?
No,
I can't say I have.
I don't often apply for jobs that require me to hit people in any fashion, so.
So then is it that widely known if we've never even seen it ourselves?
I don't know. Maybe there are a whole bunch of jobs that I imagine would require some sort of intelligence test that I would never apply for. So maybe, or that, you know, we're all sort of humanities people here, I think. So we're not in the nitty gritty of, you know, life. We have no idea what's going on with real people.
I just love the defense of this later on in the article when they talk about how Jordan, the person that the article is about, how he would have grown bored and want to leave. So the fact that he would have wanted to succeed and to move up and to achieve more, that was a negative, and that's why they didn't want to hire him. So that's a very telling admission.
Well, this happens with a lot of jobs now, right? That's part of the problem with the economy right now is it's really tough to find a job because just unemployment's so high, so everyone's applying for everything. But then at the same time, they only want to hire people who aren't that smart or aren't that qualified because they're afraid if they do hire people and train them, they're just going to leave anyway. So it sort of creates this whole paradox where if you're talented, you're supposed to be able to find a job, but you can't find a job because nobody really wants to hire talented people.
Yeah. If only there was like, if somebody could just have predicted this sort of thing, you know, maybe back in the 50s in a novel, a really thick novel.
Hold on to that thought. We'll get to that in a moment here. That's our last news story.
No, but this is, it is scary. And especially when you consider what's been going on lately in the news with cops, you know, shooting pets. I mean, just this last week we had a story about a cop that slit the throat of a dog. I mean,
yeah.
And you, I wonder if there might be a correlation there. Call me crazy.
I sort of take the Adam Carolla approach to this issue, which is that we have our cops doing a lot of things that don't require much intelligence, like sitting at a four-way stop and waiting for someone's wheels to not come to a 100% complete motion, although for all intents and purposes, it was a stop-stop. And thus, they don't have to think, they don't have to do anything, they just have to write out these tickets for most of their time for stupid shit. If we actually had them doing things where they had to make legitimate judgment calls in the moment, so for instance...
You mean like investigating who killed Nicole?
Roger Rabbit?
Ronald Goldman and Nicole, yeah.
Right. That was an OJ reference. Roger Rabbit.
Yeah. Same thing. Same thing.
No, it's Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Come on!
Right. It's morning. So if we had them doing things that required
apparently you could be
judgments.
A cop.
Thank you. At least I could beat the shit out of you with a baton because you're white. No one cares. Then we wouldn't have to necessarily have smarter cops. Is the end my point that I was interrupted four times or something?
Oh, I was just saying it's not even just the intelligence. It's the use of intelligence. You know, you mean you don't have to know a lot, but what you know, you have to be able to use. And it seems like that's really what they're going after. They're not just going after people who know a certain amount of knowledge. They're going after people who, you know, aren't going to use that knowledge to a huge effect. And I don't know what good cops we're going to get from that.
We're not going to get good cops. What Daniel's getting at and what you're saying also reveals is they're just looking for automatons. They're looking for people who can just follow their orders and do exactly what they say. They don't want people to make judgments and say, oh, well, this person doesn't really deserve a ticket, this person does. They just want them to uniformly ticket the town and get as much money from everyone. Yeah. And a conspiracy theorist might say, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist, so I don't believe this, I just believe they're looking for people to follow their orders, but a conspiracy theorist might say they're building their army to, you know, oppress the people. I don't believe that. I just think it's people in power just like having people do whatever they say. So
wait, hold that thought. That's in our last news story. Someone who doesn't want automatons, someone who wants an educated workforce, a college-educated workforce, is none other than Starbucks. Dun, dun, dun.
I don't buy it.
Starbucks will provide...
No, I don't go to Starbucks.
They're also training our overlord oppressors. Starbucks is going to provide free online college education to thousands of its workers without requiring that they remain with the company through a very strange agreement with the Arizona State University Online. It's open to any of their 135,000 employees.
College education is a loose term here because we're talking about Arizona State University.
Oh, I mean, at least that's a real state. You know, when you have things like Figurehead State University, you're like, wait a minute. What?
Probably better than Arizona State University.
They won't have the party elements online, so at least they could focus on education and not, you know, spring break.
Do they tweet up for spring break when you take ASU online courses?
Indeed. So I think this is an interesting move. And opens up a whole new realm of potential job perks that are non-traditional.
This is going really, back to what I was saying in the last thing. They're just making sure they're overeducated and unemployable to anyone else. That's all this is. They're locking in their employees.
Well, it's smart.
Yeah, I mean, you never know. The market could turn around and having that education might be a good thing later on anyway. Even if for now they're just a barista. But what I find interesting is later on in the article, the way that the writer describes it, quote, in a low-wage service industry, Starbucks has for decades been unusual, doing things such as providing health insurance, even for part-timers, and giving its employees stock options. Disney has been doing that for longer than Starbucks, thank you. Like other food and drink chains, it has also been accused of using improper tactics in fighting unionization drives. Apparently, they don't see the correlation between not having a union and being able to provide health insurance even for part-timers. So I don't, it's interesting, Mr. Columnist.
That's actually That's actually very funny that those senses follow each other. It's sort of like what's going on in Seattle right now with the whole $11.25 per hour minimum wage.
Well, it's not sort of like this. Starbucks is based in Seattle, so this is probably a reaction to that sort of movement. So they're saying, look, we don't mistreat our employees.
True, true. So the employees now who are making the $11.25 minimum wage are completely unhappy with it because now they have to pay for their own. So, for instance, this is on an airline that this story comes from. They have to pay for their own parking. They have to pay for their own meals. They have to, they dropped their health care. They had other sort of like holiday bonus that they don't get anymore. They get less time off. So yeah, we'll raise your standard salary to $11.25, but we're going to take away all the stuff that makes this job, you know, interesting or fun or at all manageable for you. So sorry.
Right. There's a finite number of resources that the company can allocate to different, costs. One of the costs is salary for the employees, and other costs is benefits for the employees. If the cost for the salaries raises, well, that means they have less to give to the cost for benefits, and they're going to take the benefits away. So basically, you've just taken what they were going to give to you, and you've demanded how they're going to allocate it. You haven't given yourself more money. You've just told them what to do with the money they're giving you.
Yep. And you haven't made yourself more valuable, more deserving of the wage. You just kind of force them to give you more. That's another aspect too.
Shock and awe. You can't evade reality. Until the lawmakers make a law that says that you can't reduce worker benefits when you increase their wage, which would come out of a certain novel.
Are we just going to go into that story now?
I think we have to. It's the best story we have today. The novel, of course, we're talking about is Atlas Shrugged.
And if you're talking about witnessing the farce, this is the number one farce to witness.
This is the story for you. Atlas Shrugged is being made, or has been made into two movies, and the third part of the trilogy is coming out later this year.
We use the word movie.
Who is going to be in it?
We use the word movie loosely.
Movie with air quotes. And who is going to make his acting debut in Atlas Shrugged Part 3, but none other than the man, the libertarian, the legend, Ron Paul. That's right. Acting be damned, integrity be damned, we're casting Ron Paul in the movie. Said
because that's what
Armin
people
Kassler.
Go to the movies for. I heard they were going to put him in Avengers 2 because they were going to use it to drive ticket sales.
Are people going to movies to see Ron Paul?
I mean, he's in Dawn of Justice too, isn't he? Because he is the most just person.
Oh my God. Because the movie's themes resonate with conservatives, libertarians, and Tea Partiers, producer Harmon Kaslow was inclined to pack his film with personalities who appeal to that portion of the political spectrum. Wow, this writer loves alliteration.
Yep.
Like talk show host Andrew Wilco and Grover Norquist, the founder of American Tax Reform. There's a hedge fund manager named Jonathan Honig. A Fox News Channel panelist.
By the way,
well
99% of
Americans. Sean Hannity and Glenn Beck.
Okay, yes. They might know who Sean Hannity and Glenn Beck are, but the first three people you named, 99% of Americans do not know who those people are.
I think a lot of people know John Koenig. I think that they will know him. If they,
the 1%ers,
yeah.
They're going to drop billions of dollars on tickets to see this movie.
I mean, Elliot, if they watch Fox News, they'll know who Jonathan Honig is, but what percentage of the population watch Fox News and watch it on Saturday afternoon when he's on?
I don't know. I mean, they've done, the show has done pretty well, but I mean, I don't know the full numbers, but I mean, I don't know. I think it'll be interesting to see him on, but I don't know what the hell they're thinking with Ron Paul. I really wish that people would stop conflating Ron Paul with Ayn Rand and with objectivism because even though there are areas of crossover in terms of certain political positions, fundamentally, philosophically, they are opposite each other. I mean, you can't, right down to the metaphysical view. So it frustrates me that Ron Paul is going to be part of this, and it's going to be seen as if he's subscribing to her philosophy when he's actually on record as crediting anti-Rand columns that have appeared in other magazines, you know, and denouncing her atheism and denouncing her philosophy.
Well, that's the most ridiculous part about this entire story, where, so, spoiler alert, because anybody really gives a shit.
There's walkers in the barn and Lori's pregnant.
The main part of this movie is a giant speech by the character where he outlines his philosophy, as Eliot's called it, objectivism. And in the movie, what they're going to have is, as it says in the article, the Galt speech is going to be given, and then characters such as Ron Paul will respond as if the speech was given in real life and give their real opinion. So this novel has this 75-page philosophical treatise in it, and they're going to condense it down and then have contemporary political and philosophical figures give quips and quotes about refuting it and if they like it or don't like it.
God. I can see Chris Matthews up there. Galt speech, love it or hate it. Time is over. Moving on, Pilgrim.
That would at least be satirical. They're not even going to do that.
This whole trilogy of movies has just been a clusterfuck of awful. The whole marketing of it and the whole casting and production value, and it's been laughable. It's been a huge, huge joke. And it pains me because I dearly love this book, and I think it could be an awesome movie or three movies in the right hands.
Or three-season miniseries, 10 to 12 episodes each.
Three-season
miniseries, yes. Anything other than what this is, which is complete and utter trash.
And there are two quotes in this article that stood out to me as being demonstrative of what you're talking about, Daniel. The first is, "We put out a casting call, and those are the only guys who showed up," Caslow quipped. "It could be the subject matter. Or it could be your shitty movies."
Did he watch the first two movies that he produced? Who would want to be in them?
Well, the answer is in this next quote by Glenn Beck. "I love Atlas Shrugged. Fountainhead I love more. But who could say no?" Glenn Beck told The Hollywood Reporter. "Well, Glenn, to answer your question, me. I could say no when I quit my job and said I didn't want to work for you people anymore."
I think Justin's going to give his Justin Lesneski speech right now. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Justin speaking.
This is what happens when you have non-creative people trying to run a creative franchise. These are lawyers and business people who see everything from a political standpoint. And they're trying to run this. There's really not much else to say. I mean, I don't want to go into a lot of, like, the details of it, because I just think generally that analysis is the most proper analysis of it. I don't think, you know, the people who are in charge of it, most of them, their hearts are in the wrong place. I think they're trying to do the right thing. I just don't think they understand what they're doing. I mean, when you have, look at the Glenn Beck quote right here. It's typical pandering. He says, "I love Atlas Shrugged," but what does anybody who say they love Atlas Shrugged say? "Oh, I love Fountainhead more," because it's more acceptable to like Fountainhead than Atlas Shrugged. It's all of this is just marketing. It's all just posturing. They're trying to do the same thing they've seen the left do for years, and they're trying to do it from a right-wing perspective. And the movie shouldn't be done from right or left.
They're trying to win the culture war, quote-unquote. It is the most painful thing to hear anybody on the right, whether it's on Twitter or at a conference or anywhere, talking about trying to win the culture war and engage in the culture, because there's a part of me that feels if you're talking about winning the culture war, you're not going to win it. You know, and I think that this smacks of that. It's not even to do justice to the story, to do justice to Ayn Rand or to the philosophy. This is all about trying to make a dent in the culture in the hopes of swaying voters. But that's really all it is. It has nothing to do with the underlying premises of the novel.
Right, and what you're saying,
I mean, it has nothing to do with the underlying premises of making a good movie.
Right, that's
like,
the biggest issue.
They don't care. It's right. So what Elliot's saying, I 100% agree with. I think that the quote, culture war is important, but the way we go about it is insane. Why are you going to announce, "I'm going to make a movie with right-wing principles"? Just make a really freaking good movie and have the underlying principles be taken for granted as whatever you want them to be. Don't shove them down our throat. Don't make the right-wing version of The Daily Show. Just make a really fucking funny show that happens to make fun of the left.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I mean. That's why.
Quality.
Quality. Yeah, the first comedy show that Fox did, for example, the half-hour news hour, I mean, they had some creative minds behind it, but it didn't take off anywhere.
Manny Coto!
Huh?
Manny Coto was one of the head writers.
Yeah.
Sorry, any really? Chance I get to plug Manny Coto is, I get excited.
But the, but then look at something like Red Eye, and why has Red Eye succeeded? Because it's just there, you're just watching to laugh.
Because it's also not right or left. Like, mm-hmm. That's the biggest problem is, look, the left wing had a good strategy for trying to get people to be little one-dimensional automatons and be on their side, where they said, we're going to brand it and we're going to win the culture war. That's what they did. They created the culture war, they branded it, and they decided they were going to win it. But to fight against them, you can't go like, oh, well, we're just going to dig in on the opposite side. That's what they wanted. They created an enemy, and they want you to be that enemy and to fall into that. So the only way to win it is to go, fuck this. I don't care about the culture war. I am just going to live my life as not right or left. I am just going to live my life as a good person.
Mm-hmm. And be funny and entertaining and engaging, you know, when you're talking about programs. In fact, I think the three of us should raise the capital, buy the rights, and just do the movies right, or do them as a 10 episode web series for 3 seasons.
If I'm going to raise money to do a 10 episode web series, it's not going to be Atlas Shrugged. It's going to have zombies in it. I'm just saying.
Well, you could always add them in. And some would argue that Atlas Shrugged is full of zombies in a certain way.
Well, it is. And actually, that's funny because I did write a treatment that I submitted to them, which they never even addressed at all. And in it, Caslow asked me to describe the world and what the world would be like. So I did like an aesthetic stylistic thing. And I said, you know, the aesthetic should be very similar to The Walking Dead because most of the people are basically zombies. They're just wandering around. They're not really thinking. They're just existing. So it should have that same sort of depressed, colorless, very slow sort of feel to it aesthetically, which is more than any aesthetic consideration they've given to any of the movies.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, I agree with the zombie assessment.
Now, if you owned the rights, Justin, you could release a new version of Atlas Shrugged every 4 years, including a zombie version, if you wanted, just letting you know.
But that's the problem, is the people who own the rights, I think they're going to continue to do that, because they're in an echo chamber where they have enough money that they can keep doing that, just keep doing versions of this, and keep inviting Ron Paul in.
Yeah, I think ultimately he's going to sell the rights because he's going to have to make his money back.
This isn't about money. This is like the typical non-profit thing where it's just people doing stuff because it makes them feel good, and it doesn't matter if it's beholden to reality or beholden to a profit at all. They're just doing it because, you know, they think they have a mission or something. And that goes back to what you guys are saying about the culture war and what I'm saying about digging in. They think they're creating the right-wing answer in Hollywood to leftist Hollywood, and that means they're above any critique, because any critique they're just going to see as left-wing Hollywood.
Well, the other issue is that, Atlas Shrugged, the story, it's not just against the left. It's against a certain segment of the right. In fact, I would say probably a huge section of the right as well. So that's why trying to make it a right-wing movie won't work, because at its core, it's a combination of the philosophies of the left and the right, just in different ways.
Right, and that's why I'm saying the only way to win the culture war is just to be fucking rational. It's not to dig in and be enemies. That's what they want. But since we're talking about things that will only be watched on Netflix, let's go to TV with JML. Put me into this week I will be foregoing the binge watch update because all I have been watching is the World Cup, and that's, you know, a sports segment, that's not a TV segment. Do either of you, Daniel or Elliot, have anything you want to briefly talk about that you have been binge watching?
Still continuing on my house binging, still getting spiritual fuel from that, although we're now starting to get into the later seasons where they try to take down House's characters in some bizarre ways, and I don't like it.
Yeah, but it gets better towards the end. The last couple of seasons, one is where he learns you can't, like, try to please other people your whole life. Then he starts, next season he learns that through his relationship with Cuddy, that it's not about making another person love you to gain your legitimacy. So the last three seasons, it picks up again. Just kind of in the middle there, they lost their way a little bit.
Oh, no, I agree. I'm just having to forge through these seasons, so.
Yeah, but they do some interesting things with the whole finding new team members. Are you at that point yet?
I'm starting. God, he just got out of the loony bin. Drug rehab. I don't even know what season that is.
Yeah.
Beginning of season 6? 5? 4? 3? I have no idea.
Elliot, is there anything you have been binge watching or want to talk about, or are you ready to move on?
Well, not on Netflix, but I've been watching Enlisted, which is the show on Fox. And it's about the about soldiers who stay home in the rear guard, I guess you could say.
Rear detachment.
Rear detachment. And they take care of the family and the wives and sometimes husbands and the kids of soldiers who've deployed by helping them around the house or doing tasks for them. And I like it because I think it's a very funny show, but I also find it to be very benevolent. I think it's very respectful of the troops, but at the same time, it doesn't shy away from making fun of certain aspects of military life. Even though I've never served in the military, but I think that it's been very funny from what I hear from my cousins and other people who've served. It's very true to life. And they announced that it got canceled a couple of months ago, but they've started re-airing the rest of the season, and there is a slight campaign on Twitter to bring them back. And I'm hoping that they will, even if it's on FX or if Netflix picks it up, or I'm really hoping that this won't be the end of that show because I think it is something special.
Yeah, there's a campaign to not cancel anything on Twitter somewhere. I mean, every show has that. Enlisted, though, is a very, very funny show. The younger brother who plays Randy is very, very good in it. He always cracks me up. I think he really embodies the comedic benevolence that you're talking about.
Yeah.
And also I can't remember her name right now, but the woman who plays the Hispanic woman who plays the soldier, she is absolutely hilarious. And when they figured out how to start writing for her, the show got a lot better.
Yeah.
She's on At Midnight a bunch, and she's hilarious on At Midnight. And I was like, oh wow, she's on Enlisted too. It's a very funny show. Yeah, check it out if you get the chance. Other things that you should check out in the future. Netflix is continuing to just sign as much talent as they can, and they've actually done something really interesting here. It has been announced that Netflix has signed Chelsea Handler. Remember when everyone thought she was going to replace Letterman when she, you know, lost her show? And they said that she will have a talk show in 2016. And they say it'll feature an updated format, whatever that means. Now, this really intrigues me because as far as daily shows go, and I'm not using that name to be punny, I'm using that name because shows that air on the daily, I watch At Midnight streaming, so I'm always a day late, but I do watch it typically every day. So can the model of having a talk show that airs every day on a streaming service work?
That's a good question.
It is interesting. I mean, so the one thing Netflix doesn't do at the moment is sort of update content daily. So that's what they would have to do with this show, right?
Right, assuming it's a daily show. You know, maybe it's a weekly or a monthly or something. I don't know. But how does a talk show work if it's not daily?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I guess it could be weekly. I mean, we're kind of a talk show, right?
We're more like a rant show, but yeah. So I think this could be interesting. Maybe they're going to actually live stream it through Netflix, which would also be an interesting new element to them.
Maybe that's why they're waiting until 2016. Maybe there are other changes coming so that that we don't know about yet.
Right, because it says Netflix is looking forward to reimagining the late night talk show for the on-demand generation, starting with the late night part. So that almost seems like evidence for what you're saying, Daniel, about live streaming it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have no idea. I think Netflix has been one of the more innovative companies in the past 5 years, and so far I've been super pleased with everything they've done. Except that one little tiny weird misstep where they separated the company for a second there with the DVD people and the online people. That was dumb. But other than that, they've been pretty cool.
So if they're going to do this and they're going to live stream it, is Chelsea Handler the one to do this with?
I think she's sort of surprisingly engaging. Like Fiza, my girlfriend, used to watch her show and I sort of used to scoff and think it was dumb. And then when I started watching it, I got a little hooked. She's amusing. She has some sort of bizarre delivery that makes me just want to sit and stare and see what'll be said next.
Yeah, it's kind of the train wreck principle, which was why she was on E, right? It's like, what ridiculous thing are these people going to say next?
Yeah, but it wasn't, it was still, no, I think that's true to a large degree, but it was train wreck in like, how artful can the pile up get?
Right.
I like that.
But here's the other question I have about this. Is this Netflix being a few years too late? Wouldn't this have been better to do with Conan O'Brien?
Well, maybe, except that Conan has turned out to be not as huge a success on TBS as they would have hoped.
Isn't that because he's on TBS, though?
I don't know. I mean, if he's such a big draw, then people would have turned into TBS, right?
Yeah. That's a good question, but I think maybe they weren't ready to do it before now. Maybe now they actually, there's actually an opportunity to do it. But who knows what they've had on the drawing board, you know? There are probably a lot of ideas that they haven't announced yet that we don't know. But this will be interesting. I think this is the wave of the future. Everything's online. Everything's streaming. Everything is going to be at your fingertips. And, it's exciting to see us getting there little by little.
Yeah. I mean, I think one thing that sort of goes underrated about Chelsea Handler is her ability to draw a live audience, for instance. She sells out enormous enormous venues for stand-up comedy.
And that's the other thing in this deal.
I've never seen, but yeah.
That's the other thing in this deal is Netflix is going to air her comedy special as well. Because that's important to remember is this is going to be 2016, so she's going to be doing stand-up for the next year or whatever.
But that's interesting though because you take someone like Kathy Griffin, for example, she sells out her venues a lot. But when they gave her a talk show on Bravo, of all networks, it didn't do very well. It never came back. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens with Chelsea Handler.
I think they're just banking that Chelsea hasn't hit her full market potential yet. I think she's popular among her fans. I think she's a good revenue generator. But maybe she just hasn't hit that stride yet. So we'll see.
Right, and this is what Elliot was just hinting at, and I find this really interesting in the sort of internet age we're in. In the age we're in, it's a lot easier to find a niche market and kind of sit in that and make like a decent living, right? So you're not like super famous. But you don't have that same necessarily crossover appeal, and that's what Elliot's talking about with someone like Kathy Griffin. So to me, in today's day and age, it's what defines that crossover appeal? Is it you just water it down so much that everyone can find something in it? Or can you find someone who's truly talented enough that everyone loves them? Because if you look at someone like Conan O'Brien, he really is a niche market now, which is why he ended up on TBS and those are the people who watch him. And I think maybe NBC knew that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder, can Chelsea Handler cross over like that? Or what does it even take to cross over like that?
This is a bit tangential, but I would ask, who do we think the huge crossover stars are?
I mean, I don't even know anymore.
Even someone like Jimmy Kimmel, for instance, who's taken over one of the most famous positions in late night, isn't drawing the ratings of anywhere near what it used to in the past. Now that has a lot to do with competition, but my point is there a huge crossover star anymore at all?
Right. I think that's the logical question to go to because, like you said, you try to just like dismiss the competition thing a little bit, but isn't the competition thing what creates the niche market? The more competition there is, the more niche markets there are because the more diversity of places to spend your money are. So is the crossover star dead? And, you know, should a company like Netflix just try to create a talk show and then try to make as many niche talk shows as they can? Because what's stopping them, if this is successful, turning Bill Burr's Monday morning podcast into a Monday morning talk show on Netflix? What's the difference between that podcast going up on iTunes and it going up on Netflix?
I think what's stopping them is getting Bill Burr up before 9 a.m.
But he could record it on a Sunday night like he normally does or whatever. You get the point I'm making, though, right?
Of course I do.
Really? I mean, but, like, in terms of crossover stars, I don't know. Like, I could see someone with a lot of charisma, like a Neil Patrick Harris. You know, I think he would probably draw a lot of viewers to a talk show, depending, because he's multi-talented in a lot of ways. So, I don't know. I'd be very curious to see if he goes that route.
Yeah, I mean, I could see it with someone like that, too. It's sort of like the Ellen principle, right? Like, I think Ellen, when people actually sit down and listen to her, she appeals to a wide audience. But even then, when is her show on and what kind of ratings does she pull? Because then it's about the time that it's on. Which, again, that's probably why Netflix is doing this, because you can watch the Chelsea Handler show at whatever time.
Right. Exactly.
So, speaking of networks that have been innovative over the past few years and have really created a market for themselves, AMC. They've done something really interesting with one of their products. So we're familiar with Breaking Bad and how they're doing the spinoff Better Call Saul. Well, the interesting thing they've done here is they've delayed when Better Call Saul is going to come out, and they've already ordered a second season. So AMC president Charlie Collier said the following. Production on Better Call Saul is underway, and we cannot be more proud of nor more excited about the work to date. We joined the fans in eager anticipation for the series, and today we happily confirm that our initial Saul order is for 2 seasons and a total of 23 episodes. When introducing any series, especially one with the DNA of Breaking Bad, there are countless factors to consider in making sure the show gets the launch it deserves. We have a strong history with Vince, Peter, Bob, the studio, and so many involved with this production. We are enjoying the process on Saul and all share a focus on making it a true television event. No half measures. Well, just to tie it in the last story, if you're going to have no half measures and you want to make it a true event, put Bill Burr in it. Bring him back.
I don't know how obsessed you are with Bill Burr.
Bill Burr's awesome.
Is it because he's from Boston?
Because he's from Boston and he says a lot of the things I'm thinking.
You mean he yells at stupid people?
Yes.
No, he's funny. I think he's funny. Any thoughts about how good the series is going to be? Because I am stupidly excited about it.
Really? That's interesting that you're stupidly excited about it. Because the question I was going to ask here is, has, as a network, AMC jumped the shark?
Well, if they have, I'm waiting for the next shark to be even higher and require more jumpiness, because I think this is an awesome idea.
And you think the fact that they've already ordered 23 episodes proves it's going to be good?
Well, okay, let's be serious here. AMC was already atypical in their season whatever. Most shows have, what, a 20-something season. This is just taking one season and splitting it in half and using it as a marketing gimmick, basically. So,
well, it's,
I think
it's...
Go ahead, sorry.
It's a holdover from the vaudeville days. Because the theaters would be so hot in the summer that all the traveling shows would take a break and they would come back around September, so that when TV seasons, I guess, came about, they followed that old format. But now that's going away. Only the broadcast networks really do that anymore. On cable, they'll, and like Sci-Fi is notorious, they'll air like 6 episodes, then the remainder of the season, the other 6, will air like 3-4 months later. Even 6 months later.
Or
so
summer shows. Some of my favorite shows are summer shows. Like, I'm really looking forward to Falling Skies. I think it starts in a couple days. Actually, I think it starts tomorrow night. Well, when you hear the podcast, it'll already have aired. But yeah, it starts on the 22nd, I believe. And Franklin and Bash comes back this summer. So some of the summer programming is really starting to rival the typical season programming.
Which is good, because that's arbitrary. The fall show, but
yeah, I can't tell if this is going to be good for the show or not, Daniel, to answer your question. The hesitance I have here is doing it as a drama and just trying to recreate Breaking Bad. I just don't think that's going to work. I would do it as a comedy. I really would. I mean, I wouldn't do it as like a slapstick comedy, which is everything that passes for comedy nowadays. I would do it as an intelligent one. But I would still give it more of a comedic edge than the original show.
So, please do correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought that was the intent. Didn't they say really early on that this was going to be basically the opposite formula of Breaking Bad, which was 70% drama, 30% comedy.
I mean, if they saw that story, I never saw it. I mean, I hope they do that, which is why it needs more Bill Burr, but...
maybe I'm making this up, and maybe I could go to the computer and research it, except that I'm too lazy. But I think it is going to be more of a comedy than a drama.
But it is interesting from a writing perspective. Maybe, I mean, getting the second season, so that might change what they've written for the first season, and now that they know that they're definitely going to be moving forward to a second season, I mean, what does that mean for the story, whatever they're going to do? That's going to be really interesting to see.
Yeah, I thought the Saul character was fascinating, and his scenes I wanted to know more of. So when I heard about this, I thought it was an excellent choice for that.
Yeah, and they are bringing back my second favorite character, Jonathan Banks, playing Mike. So that'll be worthwhile.
Yeah, that'll be awesome.
So it could have potential. I don't know. It kind of seems like AMC's a little bit scrambling here. I mean, they do still have The Walking Dead, but with Breaking Bad over, Mad Men ending next year, they do need sort of another flagship show. So they're spinning off Breaking Bad. They're spinning off The Walking Dead. So I just don't know what this says for the creativity, because AMC was making its money off of creativity and original programming.
Wait, they're spinning off of The Walking Dead? I didn't know that.
Yeah, that was released like last year that they're gonna do a spinoff of The Walking Dead. I mean, there are already so many spinoffs of The Walking Dead and other medium. There's the novel series, there's the video game series, which is very good. And Kirkman says he wants as much going on in this universe as possible, and he wants it all to run concurrently. So I kind of feel like Kirkman's turning into the George Lucas of zombie films, but whatever.
Daryl shot first.
It's time for Yahoo Answers. I did that sort of like the mother from Bob's Burgers. I don't know why. Just another answer, I won't pick it. And just another question. Just another answer, I won't pick it. First question. Do you think Beth and Carl make a cute couple on the TV show The Walking Dead? And they go on to explain. Even though the beautiful girl Beth is 18 and the incredibly cute boy Carl is only 14, from the stolen glances and the way they stare at each other, do you think they should be boyfriend and girlfriend? It is the end of the world after all, so I think the big age difference shouldn't matter. What do you guys think?
I think it's a little creepy. So I'm not 100% caught up with Walking Dead. So when I first read that they made them a couple on the show, that's risque. But apparently that hasn't happened. At least I think Justin would have told me if that was the case.
Well, very minor spoiler for people who aren't caught up.
There's walkers in the barn and Lori's pregnant.
Daniel, it's very minor, but you know, you can block your ears or whatever. Well, how far are you in the season?
I didn't finish the last half of the last season.
Okay, so it's not very much of a spoiler. With the age difference, it is interesting that they're writing this when they're doing sort of the opposite with Daryl and Beth. So the second half of the season, they're all split off and going in different directions in different groupings, and Daryl and Beth are together in their plot. So people naturally are saying, oh, they're going to end up together. So like I said, it's a minor spoiler. It's just that there's a Daryl and Beth episode.
So, no. That's my answer.
Elliot, do you watch The Walking Dead? Do you have anything to say about this?
The last episode I watched The Walking Dead was like in the first season.
Okay.
So, no, I don't.
Look, it has nothing to do with their age difference. I mean, it does. That's kind of creepy. But the kid is just he's not romantic interest material. That's not how he was cast. That's not his character. That would just be such a bizarre breach for him that it would just be, I think it would be horribly stupid in that universe to make that happen.
But it's interesting, the rationalization of the person asking the question. It is the end of the world after all, so I think the big age difference shouldn't matter. It's the end of the world and all, but are they talking about the potential approval or disapproval of other people? Are they talking about it from a legal perspective? I mean, what exactly is
I think Dan said it best, where if you look at it stylistically, he wasn't cast for that reason. And the reason this question, I included it, and it creeps me out, is this is an example of this shipper culture that I just don't understand. The phrase that stands out to me in the question is, from the stolen glances and the way they stare at each other. These people get these ideas in their head, and then they don't watch the show as it's intended. They read things into it that aren't there. Do you really think they're sitting there directing Beth and Carl to have stolen glances and to stare at each other?
No. How dumb.
But they do this. They go online and they create all these GIFs and these videos with songs and everything, proving that these people belong together. I just don't understand it. I don't understand how you can watch something and miss the point so badly that you basically create another narrative in your head.
Happens all that's the time.
Just weird. That's all I can say about it. It's right. Just...
Well, let's go on to some more weird stuff. Next question. Men's opinion on marriage. So I stumbled across a video on YouTube that was about reasons why marriage is bad for men. The main point was that marriage is a long-term move for a short-term attraction. The other main point was that women become manipulative, always trying to change their husbands. Do all men feel this about marriage?
No. That's my answer.
You're being very curt with your answers today.
So this is interesting. I mean, I suppose there probably is a larger subsection of men that believe this than I want to believe this. But I don't think it's a universal thing. I don't feel this way about marriage. Maybe I'm the minority.
No, I don't think it's a universal thing. I do think the interesting thing about the long-term move for short-term attraction, it is proven that attraction changes over time, right? That it starts out with the initial honeymoon period, as they call it, and then it changes. But there's still attraction there. It's not like attraction just ends and that people are married to people they don't want to be with anymore. I think that's a personal problem if you end up in that situation.
Well, I think it depends on what you're trying to get, what you want out of marriage, what you think it's going to do for you. You know, I mean, you can't reverse cause and effect. I mean, marriage, a good marriage is an effect. You have to look at the causes. You know, what are you willing to contribute to the marriage? What kind of person are you? What kind of person is the person that you want to marry? So I mean, the idea that it's because women are manipulative or the long term for the short term, I think that those are just kind of, they're misguided rationalizations. I think that ultimately it depends on what you're looking for out of the marriage. And if you're looking for the wrong things or if you're expecting the wrong things, you're going to be disappointed.
Right, exactly.
Can you just swap this and just say all the same things from the women's perspective? Like what is unique to men here?
Right, and we always sort of talk about gender issues on this podcast, right? We've talked about it in the past sort of about how there's an attack on men going on, right? And an attack on masculinity. But I think this is a great example to sort of, as you just said, Daniel, flip the script and just show how men use this to their advantage too. And men who say these things are using this stereotype of masculinity to their advantage to be irrational. So it's the whole idea that, you know, men have been denigrated as you can't control your sexuality, you just want to have sex with everyone, you know, sort of these unthinking sexual beasts, right? We're all aware of that myth.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So men who say this stuff about marriage, they're owning that myth, so then they can do whatever they want. And they can say, oh, well, you can't control me sexually. A long-term thing doesn't fit for me. So to me, whoever's writing this question is sort of responding to that negative edge of masculinity that is out there.
But I mean, it's funny because it's the same argument as people who they say, you know, don't have sex until you're married, and you know, and sexuality outside of marriage is so bad, and why we need these laws against like sodomy and other things. Beyond the idea that man is just this kind of animal that has to be penned in by an external source rather than a rational animal that can actually operate on his own, provided that he chooses to think. So, I mean, they share similar premises, even though they're coming at it from two different angles. The people who think that men shouldn't get married because they have no self-control, and others who think that men should get married because they don't have self-control, but it's the same fallacy.
Right. So basically, just be rational and control yourself and figure out why you're doing what you're doing and do it for the right reasons.
Right reasons.
Mm-hmm. It's the same fallacy.
It puts the phallus in fallacy, yeah.
I knew you were going to reach around for that one. Next question. Oh, let's continue sort of this look at masculinity. Why do some men want big muscles? Maybe Elliot can answer this one. I'm just kidding, Elliot. You know the guys who drink protein shakes and go to the gym to work out their upper bodies? Yeah, you mean the ones with, like, chicken legs who don't work out their lower bodies?
Yeah.
I mean, this is a phenomenon they've identified, right?
Yeah. Sure, of course. This is something in the world, yes.
But I think that a lot of it is also personal choice. I think there are some people who think they want to develop those big muscles and they want to have that physique, but there are other people, and, you know, we probably know, or at least know a few within, you know, like the paleo and other communities, they don't really have the big muscly physique, but they have lean bodies and they're tight and they're able to have a significant amount of flexibility and still some strength. So I think that there's some personal choice in here as well. I don't really know why somebody would want big muscles per se, but as long as you're doing it safely, I don't see anything wrong with it.
Well, I don't think they're getting at the whole working out to be healthy thing. I think what they're getting at is one of the things that always is missing in the sort of feminist debate is feminists will say, oh, well, we have unrealistic expectations of female body image. You know, not all women look the same. There's diversity, blah, blah, blah. I do think that same image is put on men in contemporary culture. And I think some men go and work out like this, and I don't necessarily think it's the protein shakes that are doing it. I mean, you can work out healthily with protein shakes, like you were saying, Elliot. But there are some men who go there to get as big as possible because they have the body image issues as well. They have this ideal of what masculinity is that they think they have to live up to.
Certainly, and some of it is self-esteem issues or dealing with childhood trauma. You know, if I can be strong, no one can ever hurt me again, that sort of thing. Some of it is just purely an addiction to the working out end of it, which studies have now shown if you extreme amounts of workout, your body can become dependent on it in the same way.
It's the Legally Blonde thing. You know, exercise gives you endorphins. Endorphins make you happy. Thank you, Elle Woods. But there's truth to that. Anything that generates endorphins in your brain or moves the chemicals around in your brain could very well become an addictive thing. And that's probably what's going on here.
You got your science education from Legally Blonde?
Just a reference. It's probably totally bullshit too, because it's the movie was like 2001, so it's probably not even verifiable.
No, it's not bullshit. I mean, I try to work out, you know, every Monday through Friday, and I do feel better after I've worked out. So I don't think it's bullshit.
Yeah, there's some truth to it, I think. But I mean, the point is, I think there are a lot of reasons why men would quote want big muscles, but whether or not you should.
Right, whether or not you should is a personal choice to make sure you're handling it in a way that's not destructive of your life, and it's a way that's building your life. Mm-hmm. Next question. Mm-hmm. Who is more likely to stop animal suffering, a paleo or a vegan? They explain. Lately, I've been thinking there are some advantages to being paleo if you care about animals. You're a consumer of meat. You pay more for properly cared animals. You hunt for some of your meat so you're obviously going to support biodiversity. I'm not sure it's such a bad idea.
I think if you're choosing your dietary needs based on whether or not you want to save animals, you're too far gone for us to give you a rational answer to this question.
I think that's true, but I think the question also reveals something that, you know, vegans, vegetarians don't really want to talk about is people who are rationally eating meat aren't going to want to kill all the animals the way they make it seem and aren't going to want to hurt them. They seem to necessarily link, like, torturing animals and killing them all with being meat eaters.
Yeah, there's always been, I think, a paradox there. So, for instance, the only reason that the buffalo haven't gone extinct in our culture is not because of some environmental protection or whatever. It's because people rediscovered that they were tasty. Mm-hmm. And so we decided to raise them so that we could then eat them. And now we're never going to run out of buffalo.
Well, like in Africa with the elephants, the gaming licenses. I mean, the elephant was on the verge of extinction, and they started selling gaming rights and hunting rights to people because for the tusks. And so, and all of a sudden, the elephants started thriving. And they started thriving because they understood, hey, this is a moneymaker for us. People can come to the preserve to hunt. We should probably protect and breed some of these elephants.
So I want panda burger. That's what I want. Because that's my day of the pandas, is so that I could eat them on a bus. Well, if I'm doing paleo on a bed of lettuce.
Or eucalyptus leaves, awesome. Right? Or bamboo. You would eat panda burger on bamboo.
You might say that with some wasabi.
And then it'd be really difficult for you to want to have sex with anyone after eating the panda burger. Panda jokes!
Sort of lay there.
Panda jokes!
I don't want to reproduce.
We need you to fuck so we can eat you. Come on, pandas. Come on.
Probably the best thing anyone has ever said to a panda.
Next question.
So vegans are dumb. I hate them. Moving on.
Next question. Should I bother getting rid of these cockroaches? Now that question is kind of ridiculous enough on its own, but I picked this one because I know Elliot and Drew love long stories. So pull up a chair. This is a multi-paragraph story that makes me wonder, why is this person even on Yahoo Answers? Because actually the grammar in it is pretty good. So, shocking. I recently graduated college, which shocking that he has good grammar coming out of college, right? But needed a place to stay near the school to finish out my internship. A friend is away from the summer. Okay, first mistake. Unless he's running away from the summer. That's funny. So he's letting me sublet his apartment. Admittedly, I should have had an inkling and done my research, considering the apartment is in a low-rent neighborhood in Newark, but I honestly would have ended up living here anyway, just for the convenience. In any case,
all right.
These roaches are a serious pain. They're mostly confined to the kitchenette, and only really come out in force at night. But it's still a hassle having to sidestep an army of bugs every time I want a glass of water after 8 p.m., by the way, I'm picturing that movie starring Jerry O'Connell where the cockroaches like all talked. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Joe or something?
Is it Joe's apartment?
Yeah, Joe's apartment.
Yeah.
Sort of like Toy Story with roaches. They come out at night and like hold a fair and stuff. I've sprayed Raid on every baseboard and under every appliance in the apartment, and thankfully that's kept them at bay somewhat, but I can't seem to get rid of them. I really don't think I'll be able to either, considering this is the third apartment this friend has had in this complex, and he's had roaches in all of them.
Maybe it's him.
Maybe your friend is the king of the cockroaches. Like, he's actually, this is like Men in Black. He's an alien dressed as a cockroach. No, wait, no. He's an alien dressed as a human. He's an alien cockroach dressed as a human.
Waiting for the Men in Black to come get him, is that it?
In any case.
Your friend Vincent D'Onofrio.
In which case, do not exterminate the cockroaches, because that's awesome. In any case, do you think it's worth spending the time and money to hire a professional exterminator to check the place out? On one hand, it'd be nice to live without bugs. On the other hand, I'm only here for 6 more weeks, and exterminators don't come cheap. I'm not too worried about what the renter comes back to. He's more a friend of convenience, the kind of kid who stole my dead grandpa's American flag once. Because you weren't doing anything with it. That's apparently what he said when he stole it. I'm sure he can deal with a few bugs since he's lived here for a while.
Wow.
No, I don't think should kill these bugs. He should try to contain them as much as he can. Cockroach army, so that when his friend comes back, the walls are just black with the wings of roaches. And then you can scrawl underneath it, like, once he wipes the roaches off, like,
That's for the flag, bitch.
So this just became Candyman, except instead of bees, it's cockroaches.
Mm-hmm.
So somehow hire Tony Todd.
Well, is he doing anything, Tony Todd, right now?
Being awesome somewhere.
Do you have to ask that question? Is he doing anything?
Yeah.
No.
If this is an apartment, I mean, I'm sure the guy has a landlord, right? So why not, isn't the landlord responsible for exterminations, that sort of thing? I mean, why not just go to and get it done?
You have flawed premises here. First off, your flawed premise is this is in Newark, New Jersey, okay? Your second flawed premise is this is low rent apartment. And your third flawed premise is this is a college student.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
So I'm with Daniel. I would rope off the kitchenette and never go near it ever again. And then I would probably just eat out every night.
Yeah, I would zip myself up in plastic up to the neck at night and wear like a mask of some sort. And then just figure it out for 6 weeks, and move on with your life. Good story to tell people, but not potential dates.
And then find out what his dead grandpa owned and steal it.
That's right.
Revenge. The reason I picked this question is I just love how it builds, and it's just so ridiculous. Like, the question is, should I bother getting rid of these cockroaches? Because initially you're just like, yes. And then you read it, and it ends with someone stealing a dead grandpa's American flag because you weren't doing anything with. At what point does somebody go, oh, look, there's an American flag that no one's doing anything with. I'm just going to take it. Isn't there only one thing you do with an American flag, and it's you put it up a flagpole?
Unless you're Larry Flint, and you wear it as a diaper, but yeah, basically.
And if it's a dead grandpa, I'm guessing he served in the military and it was folded in the triangle, and then you put that on display. So you technically don't ever do anything with an American flag. You just display it.
Yeah, what does he want him to do? Like a can-can or some sort of intricate salsa?
And clearly the friend is a commie bastard who needs to be sent to Guantanamo. And, leave the cockroaches.
Sounds like he already put himself in Guantanamo with these cockroaches.
It's true. It's gross.
All right. That sums up Yahoo Answers. Let's see what else we can mine from the internet in our new segment, BuzzFeed Comment Theater. Here's my idea for this segment. BuzzFeed always has the most ridiculous articles about the most ridiculous thing, and we were talking about early, you know, the sort of crossover appeal. BuzzFeed sort of has that crossover where it gets normal people to argue on the internet when they normally wouldn't. I want to read those comments as if they were actually spoken in real life. The article I found is about the 5-2 quote-unquote fad diet. It's the idea where you eat for 5 days a week, and then for two other days throughout that week, you fast and don't eat at all. You just sort of drink. And this is the diet a lot of people have adapted to lose weight. This BuzzFeed article was 21 struggles anyone on the 5-2 diet will identify with. It talks about being hangry. It shows about eating a little orange, all of these different things. You know, it shows the picture of the orange. And then, of course, there are the Facebook comments below. So I'll start and I'll read the first one as if it was actually being said. This is by someone named Katie O'Smiley. This diet makes no sense. When you starve your body of the right amount of calories, even if it's for 2 days a week, it goes into starvation mode, which means it holds onto the weight for dear life, making it harder to lose it. Plus, people are probably so hungry and have low blood sugar by the end of their fasting that they gorge on more food than they need during the week. So now Elliot is going to read the reply.
Okay. Starvation mode really isn't a concern with 1 or 2 days of fasting a week. It wouldn't kick in until like 3 to 5 days, probably up to a week of not eating. So not eating for 2 days a week, not consecutively, would make starvation mode a non-factor.
And that's basically how it'll go. Somebody will read one of the comments, and then somebody will read the reply. So next we'll have Daniel reading one.
I ate nachos while I read this.
Obsessed with you. All right, next. All right, I'll go next. This is still a thing? I was outraged last year to find out it was a real diet people took seriously and was promoted all over magazines. This is exactly how I used to eat when I was in the throes of anorexia. It's unhealthy and stupid and promotes disordered eating.
Sorry to hear your problems, Gina, but for many people, it's a perfectly healthy way to eat.
See, Daniel, you thought you weren't going to be good at this.
Whilst these 21 points are true to an extent, this is supposed to be a light-hearted commentary. I have been on 5-2 since February. It is the easiest, quote, diet I have ever been on and stuck to. It works, and people have commented on how well I look, not only weighing less, but brighter, clearer skin. People have asked how I have achieved my steady, constant weight loss, but not lost my will to live. These people are now converts and are now also gaining the benefits. Costs nothing and it works. Don't knock it until you've tried it.
Agreed. All other diets depress me with massive amounts of guilt surrounding a day off.
That's not an orange. It's a mandarin.
All right, this is my reply. This is actually not on BuzzFeed, but actually it's not a mandarin. It's a Trevor Slattery.
What a stupid joke that no one's going to get.
That's a good joke. All right. And that concludes BuzzFeed Comment Theater. Look for future editions in the future. In the past. In the future's past. All right, that brings us to about wrapping up the podcast. So, what did we learn this week? Daniel?
I learned that you can actually be too smart to enforce the law and carry a gun and be allowed to use lethal force.
Elliot, what did you learn?
I learned that apparently Bill Burr makes everything better.
That's right, he does. If you ever need to fix your sitcom, hire Bill Burr. That's a good principle. Bill Burr makes everything better.
Bill Burr better.
See, it's alliterative. And I learned that the crossover mainstream star may be dead, and that's something to watch for. I'm Justin M. Lesneski, and I hope you learned something this week. This concludes our journey into the midside. Good luck out there, and remember, if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.